I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Podsave the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Podsave the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 379 of the Outlander podcast. I'm still Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Rebecca. And as we always bug you about, because it's so much fun and we're so excited about it, there are still spots left on our Pod Abroad trip. A small update, due to world events, as we can all read into our Pod Abroad trip that was going to happen this past May and was moved to this September, has now been moved to next May. And we still have, I think, 3 or 4 spots left, maybe 5. I don't know. It's a few left, but we'd love to hear from you to check out and see if that trip is something you'd like to join us at. So when we can finally go overseas, we'd love to have you join us in Scotland for an amazing Outlander themed tour. And as I always bug you guys about, we'd love to hear you. Our text community is growing. Send us a text. Yes, it's us. Yes, it's us. We answer. No, there are no, other than the actual joining part, there is nothing that is scripted. Like, it's all us all the time. So you don't get typically more than a text a week, maybe two. We do try to text about things that are coming up, but with COVID, there hasn't been a lot coming up. So there you go. Send a text, say hello, say whatever you want to 916-659-5112.
And now on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read-along with Chapter 62, entitled Amoeba, or Amoeba. Amoeba.
Amoeba, wait, Amoeba, wait.
Sure.
Okay.
In the petri, the glass petri, Amoeba sleeps tonight.
Claire is playing with her microscope again. She shows Malba an amoeba.
Amoeba an amoeba.
That's the most stupid non-spoonerism that exists. Like, I'm switching phonemes, but not initial phonemes. Sorry, what?
You're not going to put that on your license plate in your car?
Amoeba. What? Amoeba?
Amoeba. Mm-hmm.
No.
No?
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Could you imagine? I already get enough, like, weird Amoeba? People, like, what does Grande mean? And I'm like, it's an inside joke. I'm not going into it with you.
How many people ask? I mean, right now you're, like, not going a lot of places, but how often typically would you get that when you were like commuting to the office and out and about?
I got it enough. It wasn't so much commuting to the office because it would have to be people who see it a lot. But like if I go to like an event where I'm meeting friends or something and we happen to be around my car, or they see it on the way in, somebody always wants to know what it means. And if they don't follow Outlander, I'm like, you don't want to know. You really don't want to know because you won't get it.
That's the point. It doesn't matter if they want. It's not going to help you if I tell you.
Right. So I'm like, it's just an inside joke. It's not that big. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. But it also, it makes me highly identifiable to myself in a parking lot because having a silver car.
Yeah. Everything is silver and white.
That, and I have a Kia, but the same, every brand of vehicle has that style of vehicle, that same size. Uh-huh. With just a few little minor tweaks, and they all are very popular in silver. So when you walk out into a parking lot, there's like a sea of silver, a little tiny SUVs, sea of small SUVs in silver. So having my license plate be something that is identifiable and very easy to read from a distance, it's been helping me out personally. But yeah, I don't want to talk about it. Don't ask me.
So she shows Malva an amoeba. She identifies it as the likely villain. Oh, hello, cat. Sorry, we're going to have a cat. You guys know this. You know I have cats. There's no... And I have a cat who gets in everything.
She's identified this amoeba as like the potential...
The villain,
threat.
Yeah.
The thing in the water that made everyone sick, that caused this, you know, what is
Bloody
it? Bacterial dysentery?
Something like that, yes.
They should just name it Amalva.
Amalva Summer.
Because, you know, it's like... what is it? Foretelling? What's the word? Foreshadowing. And so is the next chapter, BT Dubs.
So she explains more about cells to Malva and says that their only treatment, meaning hers and Malva's, they're on the ridge, their only treatment for this whole bloody flux thing is herbs. Penicillin ain't gonna work, girl.
Yeah, that was her first suggestion. Oh, so we can just give them penicillin? That just fixes
everything,
right? Which
is really sweet. It shows that she's trying to apply her knowledge.
I'm just imagining living in that time period and
you
first
can't.
Experiencing penicillin. I can. You shut up. Listen. Listen, I'm doing it right now.
And oh, being got the it.
First, and being the
I see. That's
the
what
first
we're doing.
Group
okay.
of people. There you go. Welcome.
Applying being, fiction to past time when time travel is not possible.
Exactly. So just imagine, if you will, being part of the first group of people to be introduced to penicillin. And just seeing how it's cured, this one thing cures all these ails. Like, she's the snake oil lady. Like traveling in a traveling gypsy caravan with her bottles of penicillin peddling her wares. Like, this must be like the snake oil that everyone, you know, they try to sell at all of the little gatherings and stuff. Go get my snake oil. It fixes everything. But it won't fix dysentery. But it must be just like this miracle potion that Claire's able to make. That has to be to them like this old-timey remedy that's followed her for generations and generations.
I think to them, it's like witchcraft.
Yeah.
So.
But Malva clearly thinks it's like snake oil, because she's like, oh, so we'll just give him your special snake oil and that'll fix him. And she's like, no, my snake oil can't fix this.
So their only treatment is herbs. And Claire is contemplating its origin, the amoeba. She's like, this type of bug isn't common in the boonies up here like this. It was almost always spread via contaminated food or water. Again, not that that can happen in the boonies, but it was not Claire's experience or knowledge that was reflected in what was happening, or vice versa. So Bree comes in about this time just asking for some, like, it's no big deal. Mama, can I have some of that sulfuric acid? And she's going to be making paper. And this also interests Malva. So she gets it. And when Bree uncorks the acid, and it smells like, you know, sulfur. It's related to sulfur, obviously. Malva freaks a bit. Not physically. She doesn't scream. She doesn't run. But she has a look on her face, and she's kind of startled. And you could tell she'd smelled it before. She says that her mother had died when she was young, and she had had some of it. She doesn't go any deeper than that. Claire catches the look on Malva's face, though. Quote, a queer expression of hostility and longing that rang a small, unsuspected bell somewhere inside me. Longing for a mother long dead and the fury of a small girl abandoned, bewildered and alone, unquote. So before we go on, you know who she's referring to, right?
Malva?
No. Claire said that it rang a small, unsuspected bell inside her. So she's referring to herself. Longing for a mother long dead, a theory of a small girl abandoned, bewildered, and alone. That's Claire.
Oh, yes.
Sorry. So Claire,
I was
definitely,
only half listening
and
to you for
I don't think
there.
Until I, you know, literally like saw that and wrote it, like typed it out, I don't think I'd ever made that connection. We hear later on that, you know, Claire likes having an assistant. She's very happy that Malva picks things up quickly. She's happy that Malva is happy to be there. She's bright. She picks things up. I already said that. She picks things up quickly. But most importantly, she doesn't like overly freak out like around blood. Like, she's able to be there and be her assistant there in the like apothecary assistant or something. Apprentice, right? And so she's happy to have someone, and also happy to have someone who is so willing and so interested. And that is as far as I took her feelings for Malva. I don't mean she doesn't feel it. She does feel for her. But I don't think it hit me, really, that her feelings for Malva, that she identified with her in this way. I don't think it hit me until this read-through, which is like number 558. I don't know. So here we have textual evidence. So we're reminded, number one, that Claire was an orphan or was orphaned quite young, even though at this point, what we know about Malva is she still has her dad. She just doesn't have her mom, right? But I thought it was worth highlighting because this is something that underlines Claire's feeling for her. So there were, unfortunately, more funerals to go. I think it was winding down, though. This one was, unfortunately, for another child. Now, Claire, who hasn't slept or eaten much the past 3 days because she's been attending to the sick and dying, is woozy on her feet. So she doesn't really think about it past that. She blames it on not eating or drinking much. Not eating or sleeping much, which actually makes perfect sense, right? Roger is praying and residing over the funeral or the burial. Jamie's supporting her a bit. She's kind of leaning on Jamie. But when the child who's being buried, the child's father loses it, she urges Jamie, you know, no, go be with him. He needs you more than I do. Go. And what is Claire feeling about this time physically? Dinah tells us her arms ached. It's as though her thoughts would not obey her. Her thoughts were everywhere. And she kept seeing, as you know, when I thought of this, I thought about floaters. But she's seeing various supposed microbes floating in her mind as if she's looking under a microscope. And she's hearing flowing water. I thought that was interesting. And then the next thing she knows, she was lying on the ground.
Have you ever passed out?
No. Not that I know of.
Well, have you ever stood up too fast
and had
all the light go away and then slowly come back?
Not to complete blackness, but lightheaded where I felt it. Okay, I will say this. I take it back. So I did not pass out, but one time when I was in Germany, I don't know, I may have even talked about this on a previous episode. I was studying abroad in Germany. I was in undergrad. Well, only there for a semester at a university. And this is before cell phones, people. Yes, I'm that old. No, that's not true. There were cell phones. We had them since college. I was like a senior. So cell phones existed, but I was overseas. Like I did not own one, right? And this is in the days of MCI. Remember that? Before the whole phone telecom bust up, whatever? I had a phone card. And some students paid to have phones in their room, or some of them had cell phones. Like I didn't have an international plan. So I would use this phone card down in the basement or first level of this dorm to use the, basically it's a phone booth, indoor phone booth. And they had a heavy door. So it kept, you know, it was pretty soundproof or whatever. So I would have, I think I had a weekly call. Unless something came up, then I'd call again. But I had a weekly call, or I made a weekly call to our parents, I think. And one day, I don't know that, I think I wasn't feeling so hot, but I felt kind of like so-so, but not awful. And I was on the phone. I didn't feel awful enough not to call. So I made the call. And I remember the floor. It was a tile floor. And it was like the chessboard. It was like checkered black and white. Big tiles, not small. And I was in that little booth. And I was talking to mom and dad. And in the middle of this, of our conversation, like it was like a heat wave, like a heat, what do you call it? Like a hot flash. I was like 21. So no, it wasn't anything like that. And it wasn't my time of the month. It was nothing. It was not great. At this heat, it felt like this heat flash? Hot flash came through my body. And like literally as it swept over me, the sweat followed it. It was like that fast. And I immediately, at the same time, I was nauseous. My head was feeling weird. And I thought, this is really weird because I'm not sick. I'm not, you know, throwing up. I don't have a cold. There's nothing that brought this on that I know of. And so I went on for a minute or two, but I was like, mom and dad, I got to go. I don't feel so hot. So I hung up. I opened the door, went out. And as soon as I closed the door behind me, I fell. And I, thank God, caught myself with my hands. I could feel myself falling, so I think I went down to my knees, but I caught myself on my hands. I am not kidding you. I had to crawl up the stairs on my hands and knees. If I stood up, I think I would have passed out. Again, I may have vomited later. I don't know what it was, but I had to go basically, I had to find someone else. I didn't know anyone who was home at that point. So I had to go. I went up to the third floor where another American was staying, and I knocked on her door and I said, please take pity on me. Can I just lay on your extra bunk for a little bit? And she's like, sure. And I went in and I fell asleep for who knows how long.
So you were going to go contaminate her with whatever you were dying from?
No one else was sick. I didn't have any other symptoms except that.
Patient
X. Never came back. Stop. My point is, so I guess to answer your question, I guess I have almost passed out. I don't know. I still don't know what it was. It's so weird. But that's happened once. And I the reason I remember the floor is because I almost hit it with my face. And I was looking at the floor as I crawled across the room. So yes, I guess I almost have. I have not painted that I know about, but I have almost passed out due to some illness.
It's always surreal.
Oh,
it's definitely more surreal when there are other people with you. When you're by yourself, it's kind of like you pretty much wake up where you went down.
Yeah.
So you're confused, but you wake up where you went down, as opposed to, you know, like when you're going under for surgery where you're in one place and then when they wake you up, you're like, where am I and what is happening? Or if you're with a group of people and they've moved you. If you start to pass out, they either catch you or they move you. So you're not in the place where you started, which is why it's already disorienting enough to go from being awake to on the ground or someplace else, but to have you be literally in another place where you're like, how on earth did I get here? What is happening? I mean, I can only imagine people who pass out and wake up at the hospital wake up terrified because they're like, I was just at a sporting event and now I'm in a hospital room covered in tubes and there's strangers surrounding me and I have no idea what's happening. I can only imagine. I mean, I've passed out a few times and it's very disoriented. So I have the vivid recall of that disorientation when I read about people, especially in this chapter.
Yeah. And the only time I didn't pass out, I mean, it was drug induced, medically induced. The only time I've been out of it for any kind of surgery, and I know I'm very fortunate to not have, you know, needed surgery up to this point, hopefully for the rest of my life, was when I had my wisdom teeth out at 19. I remember being in the chair, and I may have told this on the show too, being in the chair, and I knew the drugs were going to win. There's no competition. However, I told the doctors or nurses or whoever was around me, I said, look, just so you know, I'm going to try and beat it. I'm going to try and like stay awake as long as I can. I don't even know if I got to two. It was that. It was that. But I was out. I had the surgery. And the next thing I knew, I was awake on their recovery couch, I guess. They take you and walk you over to this couch that's draped with a sheet because obviously they have to wash the sheet. And I was there, I guess, the recovery until our dad came and picked me up. And I don't remember what I said or how I felt. I was definitely, I was so out of it. I was so out of it. And this is what I do remember. And I don't know if dad remembers it, but he might remember it though. I don't know. So he picked me up. We get in the car. He's like, how are you doing, Dolly? And we just chatted. I chatted some kind of shiz and nonsense. And what I do remember saying is, I want to do that again. I have no experiences like this.
Now we know the real reason Ginger's afraid of recreational drugs.
What? I just said.
I wanted to do it again.
That's
what I'm saying. You're afraid. You don't want to go over. You don't want to go over there. You might not come back. You'll come back different.
Well, anywho's old. So that's my experience with being. Yeah. Okay. So Mia N writes, quote, and I had to look this up because Merriam-Webster did have it, but it's one of those words I can't explain. I cannot explain why they don't have it. But it's one of the few terms that they do not include a pronunciation for, because most words you can click the play button and they'll play it. So I'm going to do my best. I know how to pronounce amoeba, so I'm going to do the best for this word. Quote, amoebiasis. Also known as amoebic dysentery, is an infection caused by any of the amoeba of the entamoeba group. Symptoms are most common during infection by entamoeba histolytica. Thanks so much, Mia, for thinking of me. To continue, amoebiasis can represent with no, mild, or severe symptoms. Symptoms may include abdominal pain, diarrhea, or bloody diarrhea. Complications can include inflammation and ulceration of the colon with tissue death or perforation, which may result in peritonitis. People affected may develop anemia due to loss of blood, unquote. And I'll include that link in the show notes as well in the Wikipedia article. Mia continues, this chapter further develops the clinical intern-doctor relationship between Claire and Malva. Claire is genuinely and poignantly excited by her students' interest and progress. Claire seems to really like Malva as a person as well. Malva's innate curiosity and intellect is further displayed during her conversation with Brianna regarding how to make paper. And we get some foreshadowing here. Quote, I'd caught the look on her face, though, a queer expression of hostility and longing that rang a small, unsuspected bell somewhere inside me. End quote. That's what I said, Mia. Claire's investigatory clinician skills are exhibited as she mulls over the symptoms and circumstances of her patients during the recent horrific dysentery epidemic. She cannot stop thinking about it all, even during the terribly sad funeral of the child of the Ridge, while surrounded by her neighbors and family. Diana's skill at shocking her reader jars us out of false security. Quote, then I was lying on the ground with no memory of falling, no memory of ever being upright. The smell of fresh, damp dirt and fresh, damp wood strong in my nose and a vague thought of worms. Unquote. And, quote, a great amoeba floated majestically in darkness before me, pseudopodia flowing slowly, slowly, in welcoming embrace, unquote.
And that was chapter 62. Moving right along to chapter 63, entitled Moment of Decision.
So as we learned in last chapter, Claire is ill. Diana takes this inside her physical and mental struggle in this chapter. Now, this is probably, at least on the ebook version that I was reading, or it was on my phone. So as the screen is so much smaller, it seems like you're experiencing more pages. It's not. It's just you can only show so much text, right?
It's
so
only
on
three
the
pages.
it is?
Yeah, and it was like three. It was super short. I listened to it this morning and I was like, oh, that was fast.
My description or whatever rundown of the chapter is really not much. I don't spend time on any detail of her physical and mental struggle. You can read about it. She goes through physical and mental struggle, period. Okay, at one point, she literally has an out-of-body experience floating above herself. She sees herself with bloodless, pale skin. She sees her bones and matted hair. And she is having a discussion with herself whether or not to let go. Now, something I've noticed only since the show came out. I did not pick this up in any read-alongs let alone any initial reads before 2014. Is that when Claire is near death, it happens, you know, a decent amount in the series, it seems that Diana uses phrases like, quote, rush of angel's wings or something to that effect. And if I am not mistaken, because as we follow her through her story, right, through the story of Outlander, the first time she is near death is in Dragonfly and Amber when she has Faith. Mm-hmm. So it started with the birth / death of Faith. There is language in that scene or in that chapter that has the wording akin to a rush of angel's wings, something to that effect. And it happens again when she almost drowns in Voyager, right? It's a few times, I'm telling you. So now, only now, meaning past the show starting, actually, I guess it'll be season two because we didn't hear, well, the Faith theme song is not to do with the book, right? That's the show. However, Faith's theme played in season two. It played again if you listened as Claire almost drowned. So, Mr. Bear McCreary, while he may or may not have read the books,
what else were you going to listen to? That entire sequence of her drowning was underwater, and the only noise was Faith's theme.
Was water. Yeah, exactly.
That was really hard to say, by the way.
Faith's theme. It is.
I'm like, so, Faith is
but my
theme.
Point is, it's like show, like book, but the book did it first, but I didn't know the book did it until I saw it in the show. And I was like, holy heck. And so now whenever I read it, I actually look for this and it's there. It does not say Rush of Angel's Wings, but I found it. Here, Diana does not disappoint. Quote, I felt a sense of peace and the air around me stirred like wind rushing through feathers. Unquote. That's good. That's really good. I mean, it's sad, obviously, but that's really good. She used this theme that she does when Claire's near death. You know, this is not, well, none of them are necessarily like hitting us over the head with Faith, obviously, but it's the same thing. Now, this may actually, not the show, the book, this may actually be a Claire thing that starts, and I am just likening it to Faith. But to me, I see, I because it started, the first time it happened, it was when she lost Faith. That is what I associated with. So it definitely is association with death or near death, but I associate it with near death and Faith because, like, Faith, you know, her baby girl who would welcome her to heaven when she's ready to go, whatever. So, yeah, there's that. That was kind of exciting to find. I was like, wait a second. I wonder if she does it here. And yep, she does. Wind rushing through feathers, yo.
Yo.
Is that really the appropriate
time for a yo?
Maybe not. So as she's floating above, she sees Jamie, though she can't name him. But she knows she loved him. And she sees a dark-haired woman, a girl, close to him, touching his back and talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, Summer. Give me a second. Almost done. Quote, the tender inclination of her head, the intimacy of her body swaying toward him, unquote. Mm-hmm. Ghost / spirit, Claire,
this will not do.
Quote. Okay, I have something to say about that too. It's really interesting to me. So I know we're looking at the book, we're not talking about the audiobook, but I have a comment about it. So Claire's like, quote, no, I thought with great calm, that won't do, unquote.
Exactly.
So the voice in my head when I read this, the one I hear is the voice I hear narrating it, as well as the way Davina narrates it, but that's not what I hear. Although Davina does something similar. Reminds me of a female version. You're going to laugh, of the drunken skeleton from The Last Unicorn. When the drunken skeleton is watching them escape, go through the clock or whatever, and he's like, unicorn, unicorn. He's like, that's not, he says something like that won't do. And the way he says it is so freaking spooky. So that's what I get a call back to that. It's like, damn, Claire is like, you don't want to mess with the ghost, Claire, or any ghost spirit, whatever. So that made me laugh. It's not a funny scene, but it's funny that Claire's like, I can go see my baby girlfriend with all the feathers. And she sees this dark haired presence, whom we know is Malva, or should know, we'll find out, is Malva. I don't think that's much of a spoiler because Brianna does not have dark hair. Mrs. Bug wears a hat. We don't know. She's probably gray. So it's got to be Malva, right? Anyway, it's not funny what happens, but it's kind of entertaining that ghost / spirit Claire is like, I don't think so, bitch. Even in her state, she's like, nope. So, quote, with the feeling that was once firm decision and incalculable regret, I took another breath, unquote. So, Summer, do you have any feelings? Did I lose you?
I mean, no, I'm here.
There you are. I'm like, dang, she's gone because she'd be bitching right now if she were here.
I mean, it's like, Claire's finally seeing what we've already all read.
Well, we haven't read anything like this yet.
I have because I've read the book before.
Summer,
I'm just saying
first time.
I'm saying it's just, it begins.
We are now catching up in the read-along with Summer's pissiness.
It begins. And it begins. Because this is just the beginning of the first time we see the inappropriateness. That is.
And it's not even that inappropriate yet.
No.
Oh, wait.
I know. But, you know, if ever a chapter was foreshadowing, this one is.
So Mia N. writes, Claire has suddenly become mortally ill and we get a detailed description of her. Description? What the heck?
Is that how you describe the Bible?
I guess. And we get a detailed description of it.
I need the description.
And we get a detailed description of her fever dreams. She dreams of faces and clouds, half seen, unknown, yet familiar. She imagines her own heart crawling, quote, away in a trail of reddish slime, unquote. She feels, quote, jagged forks of pain crackling and, quote, like a lightning bolt. Quote, a merciless brilliance. Quote, the fiery sword of a destroying angel. Diana's poetic writing makes me feel Claire's horror viscerally. Regarding fever dreams, Mia N. writes, quote, scientists don't know exactly why fever dreams occur, but there are some theories. One is that high temperatures might disrupt the brain's normal cognitive processes. Authors of the 2020 study wrote, quote, the basic idea is that the overheated brain is not functioning properly, and therefore dreams are more bizarre. Unquote. During the REM or REM stage of sleep, where most of your vivid dreams occur, your body tends to have a harder time controlling your internal temperature. A fever may add to this already strained process, which can lead to the unpleasant dreams. Fevers might also trigger waking hallucinations, seeing things that aren't really there. Irritability and confusion. And I'll provide a link to this citation also in the show notes. Mia continues, the next page of description leads to Claire leaving her body, floating above it as an observer, clearly close to death. Her eyes were clear, Diana describes. She describes the beauty of the wooden beams as she touches them and then realizes they are 8 feet above her bed. She observes herself lying upon her back, quote, the quilts rumpled and scattered, unquote. Her, quote, skin was the color of pearls, bloodless, pale, and shimmering. So thin, quote, the heartbreaking beauty of the sculptured skull, unquote. Diana does lavish her adored heroine with such beautiful words. You are so lovely, says Claire soundlessly. Let us go. I felt a sense of great peace, unquote. And then Claire's actual soul sees Jamie standing at the window, although she doesn't recognize him. Typing these words make me weep. Quote, I had no name for him, and yet I loved him, unquote. And finally, in an oddly amusing twist, it is Claire's jealousy and protectiveness of the grieving Jamie that brings her back from the brink of death as she observes Malva, whom she also does not name. Quote, the way she looked at him, the tender, I already read that. Yeah, I'm not going to read that. So yeah, Mia gets it too.
Everyone is going to get it.
Ever gonna get it, ever gonna get it, ever gonna get it, every woo 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 woo. Okay.
That's weird. And we're gonna finish off this week's read along with chapter 64 entitled I Am the Resurrection Part Dieu.
Claire is recovering. Roger is there next to her praying. She says his name. She is very weak. And then Claire understandably freaks out when she feels sensations she's not used to feeling on her head. Malva and Mrs. Bug had cut off her hair. Ugh.
Nothing worse, man. Let's fall asleep first at a party. Someone's going to mess with you.
They thought
don't
it
fall
was
asleep first at a funeral. They're going to shave your head.
They thought it was what you did for someone with a terrible fever. And Roger actually tells her, you know, TT and all. He's like, Claire, that's what they do. And he wants to get Jamie, but she does not want him to get him. But Roger's like, he's already seen you.
Yeah, too late.
And she says, what happened? And Roger says, he cried. So she tells Roger, okay, bring me up to date, dude. Bring me up to date on the sickness. What's going on? And he shares that it has stopped spreading. No more deaths have occurred. And Claire has been ill out of it for a week. And he confirms she was among the last to fall sick. And yes, I know it's her sick bed. And I know Roger is a married father and a pastor dude. But again, I've been saying this since book two. He's not going to do anything about it, but he's always admired her beauty. He's always had the hots for her. Not to attack her, but he's just all of it. So he says, even on her deathbed, and he's kind about it. He's not nasty about it. He's like, quote, you're beautiful. He says fiercely.
I only got nervous because...
Before leaving.
Because he leaned down to... Well, I'm listening to it. I'm not reading it. So when I read it, I can see a bunch of words at once. So I kind of know where the sentence is going. But when you're listening, I don't have the text in front of me. So I'm just listening. And I was like, Roger, do not kiss her on the mouth. Do not kiss her on the mouth, you mouth kisser.
So you mean like how we got hanged before?
Yes, he kisses everyone on the mouth. Stop kissing people.
Good grief.
But then they said forehead and I was like, okay.
So he leaves and gets Jamie. Jamie actually asks her to wear a cap, at least until her hair grows out. And she's like, how about a nope?
That was just a test. That was a test.
That
was
true.
A test. She even went back to
there.
Say, she even went back to say, he would have been concerned if I'd said
if
no.
If I had said
if I had put the, if I'd
yes.
put it on.
Yes.
So it was totally a test.
So she wants a recap from him of everything that's happened while she's been out of commission. So he does. And he notes that Tom Christie is still bad. He's still badly ill. But she's thinking, you know, well, Malva never mentioned that. So that's interesting. And also, Alan Christie was fine. So we don't know. I'm not going to spoil. Well, I guess it's partly a spoiler. I'm not going to say what it is that we learn, but we do learn. I think it's in the next chapter. We do learn that Claire's illness is not like, well, we know from her fever dream, right? There was no description of her pooping bloody flux. So we know she did not have the same thing that has been killing people. So that's just a keep in. That's a given to us. It's not stated explicitly, but it's implicit because in all of the description that Diana gives us of her symptoms, right? So it is not the same thing that I'll keep it there. It's not the same thing that has been killing people. It almost killed her. It's serious, but it's not the same thing. So she's trying to piece this together. So Malva's safe or not ill. Alan's not ill, but Tom is. And that's weird, I guess, because so Claire has a certain symptoms, right? Certain illness. And no one in her household got sick except her. And that's all I can say. Okay, Tom is sick. We don't know about his symptoms yet, but we know that no one else in his household got sick. So those are the only facts we know right now, or the observations we can make right now.
So who's pooping in the creek? That's what I want to know.
Oh my goodness.
Somebody's got to be pooping in the creek. I mean, they got so many people and it's waterborne.
Oh, that's weird. I don't
Somebody
know.
Somebody did something to the water.
Well, you know, the thing is, I can't say that because I'll give my
I mean, that's why it's so important that you have your latrines and your outhouses and other things built far, far away from where they can contaminate either the groundwater or they can contaminate the local streams and creeks. So, or rivers, be that whatever they have there. I know there is a water source near where they live. There is. No one would build a house without a water source nearby. Not a smart person, because otherwise you're going to have to be carrying it as far up and down a hill or however far and distant it is from where you are. So we know they're near a water source and everyone has access to what they thought was clean water. And the fact that it hit so many of the households on the ridge means that it was something everyone had access to, which tells me it's a water source of some kind.
But it also can pass between people. So it could have been just one water source. And then at least among a family, it could have passed between people. That's why Claire, when they first find the family in that cabin, Claire and Brianna and Marsali, Claire tells her, you know, don't touch your face, your mouth, your eyes, anything with your hands after this. And that's why Brianna freaking out, because she doesn't want to die.
Or
she just saw
baby.
A baby die, right? She pours boiling water down her arm. So yeah, not cool. So in comes Mrs. Bug with food and she's got Henri Christian. She tells Claire that, So Claire's wanting to find out what happened while she was out, right? Roger tells her a little bit. Jamie tells her a little bit more. And now Mrs. Bug is telling her the rest or some more. She tells Claire that some of the other kids had tried to kill Henri Christian, tried to drown him in his basket, but that Roger had saved him and then baptized him and scared the kids away. It's a really cute little story. I didn't need to retell it, but it was cute. The kids now think that Henri Christian is a changeling. Jamie feeds Claire some nibbles, some of the food that Mrs. Bug had brought in. But she can tell by what he's not saying or by his body language or by what he has said that there's stuff he's not telling her. And so after Mrs. Bug leaves, he says he thinks he must send Fergus and Marsali and, of course, the kids away for the protection of their family. And why? Because Fergus had tried to kill himself. And Jamie had caught him just in time. He confirms to Claire that, yes, it was after Henri Christian had almost drowned in the creek. However, it was not the one thing that made it happen. He said it was also other things, and that Henri Christian had been the final straw that had kind of driven him to it. He thought that his family would do better without him. And maybe with him gone, Marsali could find a man who could protect Henri Christian and provide better for them all. And upon hearing this, of course, Claire's shocked and sad and everything, but she tries to get, and of course, Jamie's shattered, right? But she tries to get through to Jamie, a man. She says, quote, "Don't you know, don't any of you know that it's you, not what you give, not what you can give or do or provide, just you," unquote. So part of Jamie's speaking to Fergus, he says, was also to himself. Kind of like not calming himself, but he was not, when he was down there next to the river or the creek with Fergus,
I mean, he gets
binding his arm up. He's trying to make Fergus feel better. But he now, upon reflection, knows that he was also doing this for himself because Claire was dying right at that moment. He had left her deathbed to, of course, be with his son, of course. So the question is, though, where to send them? And he thinks the options are Cross Creek or Wilmington, somewhere where they can pursue the printing trade.
Do you think that being in a city with more people is safer for Henri Christian?
That's interesting. I wasn't thinking about it from the Henri Christian side, although obviously that's part of it. I was thinking about it from the Fergus side, meaning as a provider. Now, obviously, yeah, he still has limitations, but at least if you're in the middle of the ridge, right? If you're in the middle of the backcountry, you can have all the, not that he does this, but you can have all the hobbies like whittling that you want. You have to bring in food. You have to hunt. You have to. There's no other way to survive except maybe trade, and they don't have a lot of money or things to trade with. So anything, honestly, in a city, in almost any city for Fergus is better than living at the ridge as far as him being able to provide for his family and possibly protect them. But to answer your question, I don't know.
I mean, he has a rare condition, obviously, but there is a chance that the more population density you're in, one, you might go unnoticed, and two, there might be somebody else equally afflicted because you have more.
That's
option,
true.
More,
I didn't think about that. I was just thinking,
yeah, just
absolutely.
The population density.
The one thing I would say about Henri Christian or him being in a city versus in again the backcountry,
and he's also related by both marriage and kind of adoption to the big dude on the hill. So if,
yeah, and that's why
he's protected, but he's also exposed.
He's all exactly. So he can't hide. First of all, there are too few people, too far spread apart. Every time there's a birth, everybody and their mama and their dog knows about it. Right. Not to say a small village or small city wouldn't know about birth, but you're going to have so many more people like they can't concern themselves with like another person being born. Right. On the ridge, a baby is a huge thing, number one. Number two, the grandson of the laird, basically,
yeah,
of the head of the ridge. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he absolutely cannot. If there was ever a child's or a person's condition you wanted to hide, it would not be this. Not wanted to, could hide. It could not be this because of who he was and who he was, the grandson and child. Absolutely. And Jamie actually pointed out, it's not just his relationship to Fergus, or it's not just his condition, his relationship to Fergus and his relationship to Jamie. It's also his non-blood, but as important relationship to Claire. And they all think she's a witch. So he's got a lot of negative things on, as far as other people are concerned on the ridge, he's got a lot of negative things on his docket.
Yeah.
So absolutely, getting out of Dodge where no one knows you, or at least at first no one knows you, you can start over, you can have a better chance at making a living for you, providing for your family. You probably don't need as much. It's a different type of protection. Maybe you don't have to worry about, there's going to be like, I don't know, burglars and maybe customers trying to stiff you, but that's a lot different than someone, you know, trying to, you know, a half mile away or wherever they were from their home, trying to drown your infant. I mean, come on. So there will all, we know this from future books. Henri Christian will always have issues in his life. He will always face harassment or prejudice. That's not going anywhere. It's just there's a better chance for them to have a more normal life in the city. And for, not just for Henri Christian, but also, yeah, for Fergus to, let's be honest, it's an easier life. It's not easy, but I think it's an easier life in the city when you're not having to bring in the grain. Worry about the mush pot, not the mush pot, the whiskey, the thing that they were doing, the whiskey, the floor where they were turning.
The malt floor?
Yeah, the malt floor. Like they did it because they had to do it, right? I'm sure that wasn't her favorite thing. So there are, I think, pluses and minuses of both, right? You have more people, maybe fewer people knowing about you in a big city. Or, you know, fewer eyes on you because there are more people, so you don't have to necessarily do that or have it done. However, you live closer to people, so you have maybe more of a chance to you know, for maybe not bad things to happen, but maybe more people could know your business because you're closer. But with more and with more frequent and consistent exposure, it becomes more of a, you know, just life. It's not a big deal. Oh yeah, it's the child who's a little bit different of the printer down the road rather exactly. than the grandson of the laird who's married to a witch. So yeah, his ties to Jamie are absolutely helpful on the ridge and needed, and they keep them safe, but they also, you know, canned, they point him out as well.
And that was chapter 64. Join us next time when we will be continuing our A Breath of Snow and Ashes read along with chapters 65, A Moment of Declaration, or sorry, I want everything to be or the, what can I,
you're funny.
Word. 65, Moment of Declaration, 66, The Dark Rises, and 67, The Last Laugh. And we will also be completing part 8, The Call.
The Dark Rises sounds like some Star Wars movie.
It sounds like Batman.
Yes, it does. Again, a very special thanks to this episode's co-producer, Rebecca. To find out more about how you can support us on Patreon or what a co-producer is, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you'd like to continue the conversation, you can go to our group on Facebook at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And if you're interested in any Outlander Pod branded merchandise, you can check out our shop at www.outlanderpod.com/shop.
And if you haven't joined our text community, why not? It's free. Text hello to 916-659-5112. And to find out, I don't think I gave the link earlier, to find out about our upcoming Outlander themed tours of Scotland, go to podabroad.com. And thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest is Politics.
Anish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.